Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for people who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm really excited to share this interview with you. I'm your host, Calvin Ng from Yale University. Fleeting Agencies, A Social History of Indian Coolie Women in British Malaya, by Arunima Datta, published by Cambridge University Press in 2021, disrupts the male-dominated narratives of coolie labor by focusing on gendered patterns of migration and showing how South Asian women labor migrants engaged with the process of migration, interacted with other migrants, and negotiated colonial laws. This is the first and only study of Indian coolie women in British Malaya to date. In exploring the politicization of labor migration trends and gender relations in the colonial plantation society of British Malaya, Datta foregrounds how the migrant Indian coolie women manipulated colonial legal and administrative perceptions of Indian women, their gender prescriptive roles and relations within patriarchal marriage institutions, and even the emerging Indian national independence movement in Malaya and India. All this to ensure their survival, escape from unfavorable relations and situations, and improve their lives. The book also introduces the concept of situational or fleeting agency, which importantly contributes to further a nuanced understanding of agency in the lives of Indian coolie women. Over the course of our conversation, we'll talk not just about Professor Arunima Datta's approach to writing history, but also the histories of empire, labor, and new avenues for thinking about agency. To learn about these issues and more, join us and stay tuned. I hope you enjoyed the book, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation as well. Today I'm here to talk with Professor Arunima Datta, the author of the wonderful book Fleeting Agencies, A Social History of Indian Coolie Women in British Malaya. By discussing this book, we will dive deep to learn both about the history of Indian coolie labor in Malaya, but also about how migrant coolie women exerted agency under untenable circumstances. Dr. Arunima Datta is a historian of South and Southeast Asia and the British Empire. Her main areas of research focuses on the transnational mobility of South Asians in the colonial period, which is to say the 19th and 20th centuries, across different parts of the British Empire. Much of Dr. Datta's research has simultaneously also focused on themes of labor history, transnational Indian nationalism, women's and gender history, and histories of sexuality. In addition to Fleeting Agencies, she has also published a number of articles and chapters concerning South Asian labor, migration, and women's histories. Her current research project is centered around the migration and mobility of Indian traveling ayahs, or nannies, across the British Empire in the 19th and 20th centuries. Dr. Datta also serves as a member of the editorial board for the journals Gender and History, the Journal of the Malaysian Branch of the Royal Asiatic Society, and the Asian Journal of Social Science Studies. Welcome, Arunima, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your enjoyable and deeply informative book today. So can you start us off by saying just a few words about yourself? That is, where did you grow up, where you went to school, how you became interested in your field of study, and any influential mentors you had?
Thank you so much for having me on this podcast, Kelvin. It is an absolute honor to feature in this podcast and be interviewed by you. So let's start off with what you asked, right? Where I grew up and how I got interested and my mentors. So I had a very complex growing up experience because I was born in India, but my parents migrated to the US when I was really a little child. And so my early schooling was kind of divided between India and US, but also for familial reasons, we had to go back to India when I was in middle school. And then again, my parents came back to the US when I was in junior high. So, and then they returned and then I moved to Singapore. So literally my growing up, my education has been very much influenced by these migratory trends that me and my family had. And throughout this whole migration experience, my mom actually kept a diary, which I used to call, my dad used to call an archival document, which I picked up from him, not knowing what an archival document was at that point of time. To be honest, that was my first introduction into history, even before I became a historian. So she would pen down all the experiences our family would have in these different spaces. And also in many ways, whenever we returned to India, she noticed I was having issues kind of connecting with a lot of my Indian friends or families because of the weird accent I had developed by growing up in different spaces. So she actually maintained a very detailed record, and that got me interested in South Asian migration and experiences. So that was literally my introduction into migration history and migration stories. And that kind of personal experience with mobility quickly translated into an academic inquiry about mobility when I was doing my master's. So during my master's, I specialized in Southeast Asian studies, and I was struck by the absence of scholarship on women migrant labor, especially South Asian women migrant labor in Southeast Asia. Whereas I was finding their presence constantly in census reports, in ship manifests, in postcards, various labor department reports. But for some reason, there was an absolute silence when it came to scholarship and literature being produced about them. And I got very much interested in that absence and took it up to explore what are these silences? Why are these silences? Can we contribute to those silences and making those muted voices of the coolie women and other South Asian women in Southeast Asia more audible? And in that process, I entered naively into the research phase, and I started by just going into, tapping into my friends and family networks in Singapore and South, in Malaysia, and asking people around, like, if they knew people, coolie survivors. And the first interview I did was with an ex-coolie woman who basically said, "We made the rubber empire. We made the rubber king." And that statement struck me. And I just knew from that moment that this is a history waiting to be told, and this is the history I'm going to explore. So that's how I basically got introduced into this research. And, you know, throughout the process, I've had many, many, many mentors, influential mentors. As I mentioned from the very beginning, you know, the personal mentors I had was my mom and my dad, who really helped me understand the mobility experiences of migrants in the South Asian community. But also I had professional and academic mentors like Sunil Amrit, Vinita Sinha, Barbara Andaya, Indrani Chatterjee, who have constantly supported my work and been extremely supportive, nurturing mentors. But I also had textual mentors whose work I have engaged with on the textual, space, but I haven't had the good fortune of, you know, personally connecting with them. But their work remained as textual mentors for me. And they were basically the pillars of strength and courage for me whenever I found archival challenges and silences. And these textual mentors are mainly Veena Das, Leela Bullagod, Carolyn Steedman, and of course the wonderful Anjali Arvandikar's work. These are the mentors and the background, like in the beginning kind of story where I began this project from.
Thank you so much. And I think that it really is a testament to the strength and the intervention that your book is making, that it's such a beautiful constellation of all these different themes. On one hand, South Asian, global South Asian histories, but also on the other hand, sort of bringing feminist methodologies and interventions to bear on that history of mobility. So as a historian of South Asia and British Malaya, can you tell us about how you became interested in the question of labor migration specifically, and share with us a little bit on what can South Asian history and Southeast Asian history, which are two sort of area studies fields, gain from transnational studies?
So I will begin by kind of rehashing what I just mentioned in the introductory phase, that my personal experiences with mobility, with migration, quickly translated into an academic inquiry about mobility, but also, South Asia and Southeast Asian histories for a very long time had been very much influenced by the disconnect, by the colonial knowledge boundaries that were created by colonizers. And they remained as fields which were inward looking and not so much outward looking. So my work basically brings in that following the footsteps of, you know, very important scholars like Sunil Amrit, Barbara Andaya, it basically highlights the fact that for a very long time, South Asia and Southeast Asian histories have privileged the colonial knowledge of national histories, right? And it has resulted in privileging partial and disconnected histories. Looking at the histories of these two regions through the bodies, through the experiences of the migrants, right? I joined the Indian Ocean Scholars to make the effort of looking into the connections, the history of connections, which reveal lesser known histories of these regions, but also help us reveal lesser known histories about how the empire functioned and colonial history of whole of Asia, inter-Asia connections in that respect.
Thank you so much for that. And now let us turn to the book and its chapters, because this book really addresses a broad range of archival material and thematic concerns, while providing a very fine-grained microhistory of the lives of its historical subjects. So tell us a bit more about how you came to write Fleeting Agencies. You had mentioned that you had conducted oral interviews with many former coolie women, but what archives did you turn to, and what was the broader research process like? And how was your writing experience while writing this book?
So the research process and the writing process was as fragmented as the voices and the presence of these subjects in my research. One of the main challenges of doing a transnational history is that the records that we deal with are scattered across various geopolitical spaces. So this research basically took me to various archives in India, mainly in Delhi, Kolkata, Chennai, in Malaysia, Arkiv Negara in KL, Penang, Perak Archives in Singapore. But also, it took me to London, of course, British Library and the National Archives of London, and also in US. Some of the labor documents, the Labor Department records that I found in London or even Malaysia, I found them only for a few number of years, and there was an absolute silence after a couple of records. And all of a sudden, I was at a conference in Cornell, and I was just kind of peeking my head into the special collections available at Cornell, and I found the rest of those other like labor documents, right, stored there as microfilms. And so when I say the research process and the writing process was fragmented, it was fragmented like this, in the sense that the writing and the research took place in segments. And every time I wrote a chapter based in Malaysia or London, I wrote thinking there was no other records probably that survive. But of course, going into my jaunts in various other archives, I found other sources that meant, or rather that translated into writing and rewriting these new discoveries that I made in various geopolitical spaces. So it was a constant struggle, but also negotiation to find and capture these fragmented moments of appearance and disappearances of these muted voices of these subjects. And if I was to put it in a nutshell, I think I would just say that it was a struggle. It was a struggle to find a word that captured their episodic, fleeting, transient appearances amongst the longer periods of disappearance, till the word fleeting and situational suddenly, literally suddenly appeared from my processing of their voices, or rather muted voices, while they were appearing in these various archives.
Thank you so much for that. And I think that the sort of really insight of your work is how it analyzes and investigates not simply by reading against the grain and engaging, like you said, in such innovative investigative work, but more importantly, also reading along the grain, as Anne Stoller terms it, and illustrating the conceptual labor that the term coolie was put to use across different contexts. So perhaps here we should scale back a bit and have you elaborate a little bit on the genealogy of the term coolie, because it's quite a contested term, I think. How did it emerge as a colonial category in nationalist discourses, and as a lived subjectivity? And what were its class, race, caste, and gendered connotations?
Thank you for that question. In fact, when I started working on this project, I saw in my various kind of dealing with different archives, right, oral histories, postcards, pictures, labor documents, census, I saw the coolie term being used in a various ways, like they were really varied. And so that took me to kind of asking the people themselves who were associated with the coolie work, what do you feel about it, right? And soon it became evident that there is this whole conversation about where did the coolie term come from? Was it a Chinese word? Was it a Tamil word? Was it a Sanskrit word? So without going into that discussion, I think whichever language we try to find the roots of this word in, it translates into manual hard labor. And that is how these traditional usage of this term was associated with in Asia. Now, when the colonizers arrived and they encountered this term as a term for hard labor, manual labor, they just adopted that word into their documentation of labor. So if we look at the labor documents, it's almost like the coolie term had been used by colonial administrators just as the word slave, servants were used, right, to kind of categorize a labor class. However, soon there were a lot of stereotypes that the colonial administrators started associating with the term coolie. In some spaces, it became associated with intoxication, immorality, lazy laborers, while in other spaces, it became associated with, oh, these are easy laborers that we can train and work to the greatest extent of exploitation. So I think that that's how the coolie term features in colonial records and colonial discourses, right? But soon we find that even in the nationalist discourses, the coolie term becomes adopted from the colonial perspective, right? The nationalist discourses did not make any effort to counter those stereotypes and return the true meaning of the term coolie to its usage. Rather, they took up the understanding from the colonial discourses and said, yes, the colonizers are making our fellow brethren lazy or immoral, or they are basically subjecting them to intoxication and making them addicts. So it is our responsibility to save them. So coolie word that time becomes a category of people, a community of people who needs nationalist saving from the colonialists. So that's how the coolie term enters the nationalist discourses. Now, the most interesting part is, how did these coolie individuals, men and women, and even children, perceive this term? And that is where I found it the most interesting, because in my conversations with the first generation coolie women who I was so fortunate to interview, they actually said they associated themselves very well with the term coolie because it was it was basically highlighting their significance to the making of this nation. So through the word coolie, they were kind of negotiating a form of belonging to this to the country of Malaysia, Singapore, because they had literally contributed to the making of the rubber empire. Right. However, when I was talking to their descendants, right, the third or the fourth, the third generation mainly, they refused to use the word coolie. They rather consciously use the word workers. And that kind of is rooted in the more colonial and contemporary kind of usage of the term coolie in a derogatory way, right? It is kind of a way of telling certain communities of people that they are associated with the stereotypes that were constructed by the colonialists, and also kind of disassociating them as, you know, belonging to the soil. So there is this kind of two ways of interpreting the coolie term. And instead of going one way or the other, I just used it as the way I encountered it in the archival records, which is a form of labor. And also as the coolie women themselves kind of engaged with the term. And in that process, I also believe that my book democratizes the term, the usage of the term coolie, because like Gautri Bahadur's work, my work acknowledges the fact that the term coolie is associated with the women as much as men. So in other words, coolie women were coolies in their own right and not just relatives of their male coolies or family coolie members.
Thank you so much for that really thoughtful response. And I think that that's also kind of linked to one of the most significant contributions of your book, which is this term that you coined, situational agency, in a way to recognize the power in these women reclaiming the label coolie. That is also an act of them asserting their agency, right? And the term agency, of course, has been among the most contested terms in the discipline of history, and especially in feminist histories, in the wake of, for example, Judith Butler's idea of performativity as a theory of agency, or Sabah Mahmood's critique of the presumed universality of agency. So how does your frame of situational agency or fleeting agency reevaluate the term itself? And what sorts of analytic possibilities does it open up?
Thank you for that question. So in very many ways, my use of the term situational agency actually follows the footsteps of Butler and Mahmood, but it kind of goes forward a bit to open up possibilities to focus on the everyday of the agency, right? In the way that it kind of borrows the framework of giving more importance to the everyday, the non-theatrical everydays instead of just the events. Like Veena Das's work, right? So I think my work is a confluence of various waves of scholarship, the subaltern scholarship, the subaltern studies scholarship, the feminist scholarship, and also the everyday history. And the three main things that that allows me to do is focus on the temporality, the transience, the everyday or non-theatrical, and both the visible and invisible exhibition of agency, right? And in that sense, my work allows us to see individual not necessarily just as a victim or just as a an agential actor, but as an individual within whose body, within whose persona, we see a constant and simultaneous existence of a victim and an agent, right? So I think two things. My work allows us to see that to be an agent, one individual does not have to be an agent permanently. And second, that the person does not necessarily have to be an agent in a theatrical way and in a constant way, right? While being an agent, most of these women were also being victims simultaneously. And that complexity of the term agency is something that fleeting agency and situational agency particularly kind of allows us to engage with, because most of the other scholarships have focused on, you know, the evolution of a victim into an agent, or basically a very theatrical display of their agential acts. In most of my case studies that I encountered, they were not necessarily theatrical displays of agency, yet it was a display of self-determination and voice and agency in a very different way. And that is why I struggled a lot with the term agency, because when I was reading these case studies, I found the traditional understanding of this much debated word agency problematic to my case studies. So I allowed these cases to allow me to open up new analytical possibilities of these subaltern voices, which were hidden in the everyday, not necessarily coming out in protests or riots, right? It was in the everyday by just disobeying certain orders or kind of deserting someone's husbands or even poisoning food, which does not necessarily feature that much, the poisoning part, but in the case studies. But there are cases which I did not end up using. But yeah, so it's the everyday, the transience, and the temporality of agency, which features mainly in the situational agency concept that I coin in this book.
Thank you so much. And I think that that's so beautifully put. Just a radical democratization of the concept of agency to extend it to the quotidian, the everyday, acts of self-assertion that may not be sort of theatrical or spectacular, but nonetheless sort of assert a sort of like agential resistance in everyday forms. So I want to turn to your first chapter, which is Coolie Women in the Empire's Rubber Garden, because it provides such a detailed historical and contextual background to the phenomenon of coolie labor across the Bay of Bengal. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the specific system of coolie labor in Malaya, which is the Gangani system, and how it differs from the indentured system in places like Fiji, Mauritius, Guyana, that people might be more familiar with. What are some of the political and economic concerns that precipitated the emergence of coolie labor? And how did coolie women engage with these British policies at promoting labor migration?
Thank you. So, yes, British Malaya experience or usage of coolie labor was very different in many ways from the Caribbean usage of or systems of labor import. So as we know, after the abolition of slavery, indentured labor system came in, which scholars like Hugh Tinker term as the new system of slavery, right? Where there was an agreement between the coolies and the employers, the recruiters who brought them to those plantations to labor. Now, in the case of Malaya, it's important to note that Malaya entered into this race of importing labor for plantation purposes much later than the Caribbean, right? So the first experience of Malayan recruiters, they actually wanted to focus on indenture. In fact, the very early phase actually focused on indentured, similar kind of indentured recruitment. However, when they went to recruit in India, they saw all the monopolized pockets in India where they had no scope to penetrate. And the North and East and West Indian labor recruiting markets actually told the earliest kind of recruiters from Malaya that they should go and venture out in South India, because that's where, you know, there might be opportunity for them to explore labor sources. They did go there, and they found a lot of labor sources that they could exploit. So they also wanted to make sure that they were recruiting people who were very much accustomed to plantation labor. And that is where kind of the whole middleman concept or the Kangani concept starts featuring, that they not only wanted labor sources, but they wanted quality labor sources. And in the process, they thought having a middleman would also be helpful to determine who is a quality laborer and not. Now, that was on paper. That did not always kind of materialize in the real experiences of labor recruitment. The other thing which is very important to note in the case of British Malaya is that the Kangani system allowed the planters, the administrators in British Malaya, to privilege the recruitment of coolie women specifically, or coolie families, because they were given, the Kanganis who were sent out as recruiters from their own villages, they were given extra money to recruit women or coolie families. And this is rooted in the whole anxiety that the planters and the administrators in British Malaya faced around, you know, early 1900s, when basically the nationalist movement in India had started popping its head up, right? There was a mushrooming trend in nationalist movements. And the main question, the main mobilizing factor for these nationalist movements was that our coolie brothers and sisters are being exploited. They are taken away. They are mistreated. And we need to do something to stop colonization so this exploitation ends, right? And the administrators and planters became very nervous. And they wanted to assure that there was not only a labor supply to feed the current need of labor, but also to make sure there is future continued source of labor. And in that, with that mentality, with that frame of mindset, they actually privileged recruitment of women and coolie families so that their bodies could be used not only for labor production, but also labor reproduction for the future, so that there is a local kind of labor cushion for the future labor needs of Malaya. And that is exactly how, you know, the labor recruitment labor designs kind of differed. There were overlaps between Caribbean and the Southeast Asian experience, absolutely, but they were also distinct or unique in that way, because of these contextual developments in what we call in Bahasa Malay, right? Sama-sama tapi lain.
Yeah, exactly. Same, but different.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, I think that that's really interesting because it also leads us nicely into your next chapter, Tapping Resources, which really uncovers the central role of coolie women in labor processes on colonial rubber estates in Malaya. And I think that here you pose an intervention against most works in economic history that sort of ignored the role of women, because you are really sort of foregrounding and censoring the roles played by coolie women in the rubber industry, both productive and reproductive. So here I want to ask you perhaps to elaborate a little bit on how did these women contribute to the rubber industry in colonial Malaya? And in addition to that, you trace their active involvement in labor politics from strikes, riots, protests. How were these women involved in these networks of labor activism? And how did their perceived status as vulnerable come to be a resource for many labor activists?
Thank you. So I think the first where I want to begin answering this question is that coolie women, when they were migrating to Malaya, they were very conscious of their being recruited as a body of labor, because they were signing an agreement and they were recruited as a coolie woman instead of, in the ship manifest, instead of being just termed as a coolie man plus female relatives, right? So right at the process, right at the moment of migration, they were actually very aware of their value as a migrant labor to these other spaces, British Malaya. And upon arrival, what is very striking in the case of British Malaya is that they have their independent pay slips, right? They have their own wage records. Unlike in the Caribbean, where you see mostly, in most cases, women are paid a family wage. Women are paid wages as dependents of their male relatives. That was not the case in British Malaya. They independently had their pays and wages, and which became very important to kind of allow them to understand their value, their contribution to the labor and plantation society in Malaya. Now, that being said, women entered the labor production stages, labor production process in various stages. They entered as weeders, who weeded the weeds to make sure the rubber plants were, trees were in good health to manufacture, to produce latex. They were crucial tappers. In fact, by the 1920s, 30s, you see the majority of labor on the plantations who were focused on tapping and weeding jobs were women, not men. So visually, too, they saw that they were being, they were contributing. Actively contributing, important contributors to this rubber plantation industry. And they also entered the factory in forms of labor who crept and made the rubber latex into sheets. Now, this is the factory is the only space probably in this whole production process where women were much less compared to men in terms of number. But you know, in other phases, they were already very much aware of their contribution to the plantation system. What also emphasized their importance as laborers, as contributors to the plantation system and to the colonial market, was the fact that whenever they became pregnant or they were expecting, they were given maternity benefits. And that showed them that they are valued for their labor, for their body, and the reproduction that they are, the labor reproduction that they would engage in. In fact, they were given maternity allowances. They were given more food rations. They were given exemptions from certain kind of work. And also they were given daycare privileges. Now, of course, the quality of that daycare is very contested and it was not that good, but there was ayahs or nannies in every plantation to basically serve as daycare centers so that the motherly duties towards the child did not interfere with the labor duties that was expected from these women. So in these various forms and spaces and capacities, these individual coolie women realized that they were crucial figures in this whole plantation process. And in that way, they actually, we find them voicing equal pay. I mean, today we think of equal pay negotiations as something very quote-unquote modern. I mean, modernity is something contested, but something of the contemporary age, right? But here we have these coolie women who were conscious of their contributions and they were demanding, you know, equal pays as their coolie men because they saw them doing equal, if not more, work. And in that sense, there was a lot of breaking of kind of workers' solidarity. Like in my chapters 2 and 3, you will see that the coolie men and women are fighting against each other, right? Because the coolie men wanted to hold on to their privilege of being the person who brings in the most money to the home, right? The coolie home. But women were like, no, we put in the equal effort, so we deserve the same amount of money. And in some plantations, the structure of payment was such that it was a piece rate system. So it doesn't matter what your gender is, as long as you tap so many trees and produce so many buckets of rubber latex, you are going to get that wage. So in that way, there was an gender equality in the pay structure. And that really created an issue for the coolie men, and they went into fighting with each other. But also there were moments where these women and men came together in various unique partnerships. So for instance, women being oppressed, pregnant women being abused at work, became a unifying cause for the men and women to find solidarity and basically negotiate better working conditions, better pays together. So in those moments, in those fleeting episodic moments, that partnership, that solidarity became evident, but it happened rather organically. While in other situations, those partnerships were kind of cracked, in for a lack of a better word. So what this chapter actually shows is that these partnerships were temporal, were fleeting, were episodic, as much as the women and their agency was.
Thank you so much for that. Yeah, I think that that's really insightful as to how these women negotiated all these multiple registers of gendered hierarchies. Which is also a theme that's consistent with your next chapter, Managing Partnerships, which turns to the domestic lives of coolie women and uncovers the diverse designs of coolie households, the plethora of intimate relations within these spaces. It's one of my favorite chapters of the book, especially because you argue that the stereotype of, quote, domestic violence was enabled by a more mundane form of everyday violence generated by colonial capitalism. So here I want to ask you, what is the relationship between these broader socio-political processes of capital and the everyday quotidian and conjugal intimacies of these women? And I'm really intrigued by how you take up the category of the everyday as opposed to the eventful, following Veena Das as a site of analysis.
Yeah, so I think the main argument in this chapter was to put forward the argument that there was this larger, more subtle, right, violence created at the structural level of colonialism, of the plantation structure, that entered into the everyday experiences and lives of these women and coolie households at large. However, what really gets recorded or what finds a privilege in the archival records is the eventful violence that happened in the coolie experiences and households, right? Like chopping up a partner, right? Killing, murdering a wife, or a wife beating up a husband. Those became more visible theatrical examples of violence, and that entered into the archives as domestic violence because it was happening in a space that the colonial administrators saw as domestic, but they never questioned, was it domestic to begin with? Because as the chapter and the following chapter shows, that many of these marriages were just depot marriages, were just marriages of convenience. And these coolie men and women who were living as a husband and wife often use their domestic space as a larger economical partnership space to give housing or food to other coolies. So it became a transactional space and did not necessarily remain a domestic space in the way the colonial administrators envisioned domestic spaces as. But of course, any violence that took place in that space entered the archives as domestic violence. So one of the key aims of that chapter was to question that kind of spatial recognition and classification of domestic spaces. Is that domestic at all? And the second thing was to question the violence, because the colonial administrators were constantly emphasizing, oh, coolie households were so violent. They are always killing each other. Domestic violence is basically a key feature of a coolie household, right? Where the coolie women were victims and the coolie men were the usual perpetrators. Not only is that classification wrong because violence went both ways, but it also silences, completely erases the violence that the colonial structure, the plantation structure, had on these families, right? To begin with, The men were paid more, of course, and the women were paid less. And in many circumstances, the women stayed on in those abusive marriages or abusive partnerships because they knew that on the basis of their own earning, they couldn't survive or they couldn't feed their own children. So that kind of separation was denied. Their choice of separating was denied. And that was a violence in an everyday format that entered into their lives, giving them this whole violent space to deal with, wherein the more violent acts become theatrically visible, right? So I think, you know, the main point is that the everyday is as eventful as the events itself. And that is the point that I try to make, because the events were, of course, were more theatrical, more visible, and found more voice in the archives. But the everyday created, you know, snowballed into that more eventful occurrence and is in no way any less. In no way is the everyday any less eventful or any less violent in these cases. So, yeah.
Thank you so much for that, because I think that really this chapter and the next chapter, Negotiating Intimacies and Moralities, are both thinking about the everyday seriously as a site of a contestation and the everyday as a productive site for certain discourses, certain conceptions of gender, and as well as of like interiority, the public-private sort of divide. In the chapter Negotiating Intimacies and Moralities especially, you talk about how the intimate lives of coolie women came to be mobilized both by colonial administrators who were reading them as emblematic of, quote, immorality, as well as by Indian nationalists who used it to argue against colonial irresponsibility. So how were ideals of morality constructed in this context, and how might these cases exemplify the situational agency of these coolie women?
Yeah, so morality is a constructed and very much debated term, right? And as Jeffrey Weeks shows us, that the way the colonizers, the colonial administrators, at the empire's home in Britain and in the colonies, visualized or understood morality was very much gender-based, was very much race-based, was very much class-based. And that kind of visualization or understanding of morality entered in these colonial contexts, right? Because when the colonial administrators or judges, magistrates, were encountering these husband desertion or wife murdering aspects, right, or even adultery, they were judging these cases based on their perceived notion, Victorian ideals of what is morality. But in reality, these were not marriages as these Victorian morality definitions of marriages perceived them to be. As I was just mentioning a few minutes ago, many of these coolie men and women were in a marriage of convenience. They were married just on paper, just to enable them to migrate as coolie families. And the onus was on the Kangani who recruited them like that, right? Or in fact, even them, because they agreed to travel like that. But in most cases, they were not necessarily married in that sense of the term, in the more traditional, conventional sense of the term. And whenever there was any kind of mismatch of expectations, the men and the women did not feel compelled to go with the traditional understanding of what is morality. They you know, they ventured out, the women especially took advantage of the sex ratio kind of favoring them, and found other partnerships. And I think that is a great testimony of the courage and the resilience these women had, who of course did not go out and say, I was in adulterous relation. Did not always, and sometimes they did, but they took it on them to basically find what is right and what is most suitable for them. Now, this became problematic for the colonial administrators because, of course, that did not match their traditional, conventional understanding of the term morality, marriage, and also female situation or female, position in a marriage, in a household. But it also became problematic for the nationalists because, I mean, not problematic for the nationalists, but actually I find it problematic in the way the nationalists used the term morality, because they knew about these depot marriages. But they used the term in the way the morality and the immorality issues as the colonial discourses were perceiving them. And they basically adopted that stereotype and said, all our men and women are becoming immoral because of the situation you put them in. It is the problem of the colonizers, which is basically making us as, you know, South Asians, Indians, look bad to the whole world because this is not our culture. So in one way, they are kind of owning it, but in other ways, they are kind of disowning it by saying that it's a colonial problem. And in that way, what really happens is that this morality of coolie marriages, of coolie women, literally becomes an ideological battleground between the nationalists and the colonialists. And, but when we go into these case studies, how the women negotiated their voices and choices by playing the colonialists and the nationalists against each other, and how they advocated for themselves what they needed, is where we find the situational agency, and that allows us to acknowledge their voice, which has so very much been muted.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And I think that leads us nicely to your next chapter titled Becoming Ranis, which really examines the lives of coolie women during the Japanese occupation of Malaya and specifically addresses the histories of coolie women in Malaya enlisted in the Rani of Jhansi regiment to fight British imperialism. This is very much a neglected and overlooked history. I don't think I've come across much material on this at all. So could you just start us off perhaps by telling us about what were the conditions under which these women joined the RJR, and what did their everyday lives look like? How does this enable us to rethink the gendering of political and martial strategies? And how was the space of, quote, nation being envisioned by these women combatants, and what accounts for their identification, their affective identification of the idea of India?
So let me start off by giving a little background about where this RJR, the Rani Jhansi Regiment, emerged from. So it was during the World War II, and Malaysia was under the Japanese occupation, and Subhas Chandra Bose, a notable nationalist leader, arrived in Southeast Asia, Malaya, Singapore, and started recruiting people with the help of the Japanese presence in that space to basically create these armies which would go and fight the British India Army and lead to decolonization of India. Right? So that's a very simplistic, explanation of the history, but that's kind of the background. Now, in his experience in, recruiting people for the Indian National Army, which was the men's regiment, he also parallelly was also recruiting an all-women Rani Jhansi Regiment, Indian women, to participate in that call for freedom for India. Now, most of the memoirs that actually exist till today are memoirs of the leaders, the more educated second generation South Asian women who participated in the Rani Jhansi Regiment, being conscious of this transnational nationalism and nationalist movements in India. But what was happening in the plantations during the Japanese occupation was that not so much as the Chinese women's experience, but these Indian coolie women were also facing atrocities from the Japanese soldiers, occupiers of Malaya. The plantations were mostly closed, and the men were taken to the death railway, right? And these women were at times starving, without work, had no food sometimes, and were constantly under the threat, fear of what the Japanese soldiers might do to them. In fact, in that chapter, I record a lot of kind of cases where women are constantly abused, sexually abused, taken as mistresses, raped by the Japanese soldiers. Now, this was a fear for shared by all the Indian coolie women in these plantations. And in this context, when the call for, you know, being recruits for the Rani Jhansi Regiment came up, they found that as an escape. Not to say that they did not understand what India is, but we are talking about the second generation of Indian coolie women at this point. Right? It was as much as the first generation along with the second generation. And they knew what India was. They definitely had patriotic feelings. But the immediate reaction to join the RJR was mostly because of the fear they found themselves and the situation that the RJR, the opportunity the RJR offered them. In fact, in most of the interviews and oral history records, what you find in that chapter is that these women were looking for protection, and RJR offered them that protection. They offered them food, they offered them protection, they offered them clothing, and also a sense of being proud for what they are going to contribute in, right? In fact, many women were like mentioning that they were not tin soldiers. They were soldiers in the real way. They were carrying guns. They could fight as well as the men. So there is also this gender negotiation of power and kind of courage, right? But also there was this other aspect of gendered kind of notions or gender elements being woven into nationalist or kind of military organization in nationalist freedom fights, right? So Subhash Chandra Bose was, of course, visionary, and he had organized the INA, but he also knew that the INA was going to face the very difficult situation of having the British India Army, which was going to have more weapons and, of course, more soldiers. So they were going to be outnumbered anyway. And the RJR, and this is a contested space because various oral history narratives record this differently, but it is said that Bose basically had the plan of sending the Rani Jhansi Regiment first to show that Indian women are bearing arms and ready to fight the war of India's independence. And that would be a psychological warfare, an attack on the British India Army, which was mostly Indian soldiers, right? And that would be a psychological warfare on their masculinity and, of course, their sense of, you know, belonging and pride for their motherland. And that in that way, he hoped that they would surrender their arms and come and join the INA. So there are a lot of gendered kind of negotiations and gendering of politics and martial strategies that we find through the case studies of the RJR recruits and experiences in the nationalist kind of space.
That's incredibly, incredibly interesting. And I'm just also thinking about the amount of like labor that these women contributed to the nationalist cause writ large, and how that all that labor is archivally sort of like effaced, and that you had to sort of like piece the story together. And I guess to wrap things up, what remains of these diverse life worlds today? And how do former estate coolies understand their family histories, and how do they narrate their subjectivities today? As we both know, manifestations of contemporary racism against the Indian population in both Malaysia and Singapore reverberate with force today. So what are the stakes of returning to this history of coolie labor? And how do we think about its continuities with forms of unfree labor and racial capitalism persisting into our present day moment?
Yeah, so I think it is all the more important for us to return to these coolie histories in the present day, because it highlights, it emphasizes the contribution of various communities to the making of this nation, of the nations of Malaysia and Singapore, right? And in that way, it kind of shows, democratizes the concept of Bhumiputra, which is son of soils, right? In that way, doing these histories, going back to these histories, it not only shows the connections, but also allows us to appreciate the contribution of these communities and their importance to these making of these nations, but also their claim to being equal citizens of these different spaces. And, you know, in terms of answering your question about what kind of continuities we see, there are many coolie families escaped the plantations. They went out, but there are also families who are, for a lack of a better word, quote unquote, trapped in that plantation system till date. And I think my epilogue features 3 to 4 case studies like that, where the families are still trapped in those plantation systems. Yes, of course, those are not necessarily rubber plantations today. They have been transformed into palm oil plantations, but nonetheless, they do exist in those kind of situations. And there is a lot of continuity, right? The first level of continuity is that the plantation system exists, and they are still kind of trapped in those situations, not necessarily always having better experiences. But of course, it's a free nation. The colonial powers have left. So that is a change, but there are continuities and similarities in other respects of the coolie families and their experiences. But also there is a continuity in a different kind of way, right? The South Asian labor presence in these Southeast Asian nations, especially Malaysia and Singapore, still goes on in a different context. We find South Asian labor, especially South Indian laborers and Bangladeshi laborers, in construction industries, in palm oil plantations, in garment industries. And in many ways, that also adds another layer of continuities, albeit in a different socio-political context. But, you know, that kind of power dynamics and challenges of being a migrant laborer in these situations still exist. So in many ways, there is a disconnect from the colonial realities, but in many ways, there is also an overlap and continuities in the way the experiences of the laborers continue today.
Thank you so much for that. And before we move on to our last traditional question, can you please read us a paragraph from the book?
Absolutely, I will be delighted to. So I'm going to read a paragraph from the chapter Negotiating Intimacies and Moralities. There were many cases wherein coolie women consciously played the victim and exploited colonial perceptions of coolie women as passive subjects. In a case presented before the Klang magistrate in February 1935, Periasamy, an estate coolie from Batu Tiga, charged a fellow coolie, Muthusamy, with enticing away his wife, Muthamma, during October 1932. During the trial, Muthamma, in her witness statement, claimed that after consuming some curry offered by the accused, she did not know what happened and instantly became obsessed with Muthusamy and followed him to Telok Ansan, where they lived as a married couple. Muthusamy, denying such allegations, stated, "It was Muthamma who enticed him," and that he was unaware that Muthamma was ever married, as she had begged him to be her husband, and not being able to withstand her treatment and her experiences, he took her away. When the magistrate demanded proof of marriage, Muthamma's father claimed that she was married to Periasamy. Once again, word of mouth, uncorroborated by any documentary evidence, was proof enough for the magistrate to find Muthusamy guilty of wife enticement and sentence him to 2 years of rigorous imprisonment. The evidence given by witnesses in this case appears contradictory and implausible. While Muthusamy feared imprisonment and fines, Muthamma arguably feared violence from her husband and chastisement from her family who lived in Malaya. Evidently, it was a case of two consenting individuals in a victimless act of immorality. Upon being dragged to court, both played victim as an act of survivance, but as a result of colonial perceptions of coolie women as victims of enticement rather than as enticers themselves. It was Muthamma's story that was believed.
That's so poignant. Thank you so much for that. Well, Arunima, we've taken up a lot of your time. So as a traditional closing question, what are you currently working on, and can you tell us about your current and future projects?
So I'm currently working on a project that actually I had started working on when I was a graduate student, towards the end of my PhD journey. It was about traveling ayahs and amas of South and Southeast Asia in Britain. And the way I got introduced to this was basically a planter's family had an ayah who were going back for their summer vacation to Britain, and they engaged her as a traveling ayah. And that is where I encountered the term. And I absolutely wanted to write another dissertation as if that was possible. But that is something that I'm working on right now, about the everyday experiences of these domestic caregivers as migrant laborers between Britain and South and Southeast Asia. The first of that chapter actually just recently appeared in the Journal of Historical Geography, where I deal with the responses of the British society and administration of the traveling ayahs and amas in Britain. But the book is in the works, and that is my next project.
Thank you so much, and I am definitely looking forward to it. In fact, I'm just going to go check out your article right after our interview. Thank you so much for joining us today, Arunima, and thank you so much, listener, for listening to today's episode, in which we explored Fleeting Agencies by Professor Arunima Datta, published by Cambridge University Press in 2021. You can find the book on bookshop.org or other outlets. This is your host, Kelvin Ng. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.